Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 105, where Sarah, Sam, Rowan, and Tom are discussing an article by Alvin Guldner titled Cosmopolitans and Locals, Toward an Analysis of Latent Social Roles, published in two parts in consecutive issues of Administrative Science Quarterly in 1957 and 1958. In part two, we turn our attention to the second article, where Guldner presents his findings of a study into latent roles at a hospital. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. So in part one, ironically, we focused on part one of the paper. We focused on the constructs, the main argument, the line of reasoning that Guldner presented. So here in part two, we're going to concentrate a little bit more, at least initially, on part two of the paper that was published in 1958. And this is where the resulting six latent role identities are presented. And then following that is all of the factor analysis that went behind it. So let me just rifle off the six identities, and then we can delve into each one as we wish. But there were four of them that were classified as locals. They were, number one, the dedicated, who are described as the true believers who identified with and affirmed the distinct ideology of their organization. The second one is the true bureaucrat. I guess the best way to put it is that they're kind of bureaucrats in the sense that they follow the formal rules and they value the adherence to process. It is not that they don't truly believe in the organization, but they believe in the organization through process. The home guard is the third one. The least occupational specialization and commitment, little or no advanced college training, write little or nothing, and attend few or no professional conventions. They're just happy to be in the organization. They don't contribute a lot to them necessarily, but they identify very closely with being part of that organization and probably would not fit in many other organizations. And then the last one, the fourth one, is the elders, which in this particular study was ageist. It basically reflected those who were of older age, who had built up status from within by being with the organization for so long. But there are also ones who have a very, very deep commitment to the organization that was built over time. So those are the four locals. The two cosmopolitans were the outsiders and the empire builders. The outsiders are ones who are in the organization almost in name only. Their commitments outside of the organization weigh far, far more than anything inside the organization. This would be the type of person that you might think would be like the traditional academic in the university. And then the empire builders, the description says, quote, their college commitment is tempered by a sense of economic independence. So they're not committed to inside the college, but they're not necessarily, like the cost-benefit analysis says, it's better here than better elsewhere. So they try to build up their own little empire inside the college, somewhat separate from the rest of the organization. So those are the six that he comes up with from this one particular setting. And, you know, given what we said about the setting before, and we have been fairly critical of this article so far. What do we make of these six? What do we think of them?
Thank you, Tom, for that introduction to the second part of this article. I actually found the second part really disappointing, I think. I really like the first part. I think it's a novel idea by that time, and it's nice to have this clear differentiation between latent and manifest roles. But then in the second part, even though Guldner in the first part sets up to uncover latent roles, and he alludes to these roles that are based on social identities, which can be seen as irrelevant, inappropriate, or illegitimate. And he even alludes to issues of race, gender, social class, right, as informing these latent roles. So I was kind of excited by that in the first part. But then in the second part, I don't feel that we see as clearly these six latent roles that he comes up with as being related to these issues that he planted on the first part, right? Because he talks, when you look at the six latent roles, they seem to be more informed by the manifest roles and the interest positions, resources that people can access given their formal position in the organization. And that kind of reinforces that idea of the latent role. But I don't see it as necessarily, how to say this, like introducing more complexity or problematizing the already, you know, the things that you already expect given their manifest roles. So I think that was my general opinion on by looking at this part too.
And some of the sense making, I would say kindly, seems a bit forced. Or the way of extending the theory and the construct definition. So, for example, you were talking about the empire builders versus the outsiders trying to break down the cosmopolitans. And one of the extension examples under empire builders is, unlike outsiders, these men are integrated into the college structure, but primarily into its formal organization. For example, while they will see students fairly frequently concerning their work, they will not invite students to their homes for a class. And that's the key thing that divides empire builders who are keeping an eye on the outside possibilities. Those are both quotations from page 450, with the outsiders who are otherwise have little integration, low participation, and low influence, as we just discussed, defined as being involved in decision making. So of course, we can, with the benefit of hindsight, pick those apart a bit more about what does that say about the environment of academia at the time. But I think just using that as an example to divide up the cosmopolitans, actually these outsiders look like neither extreme in the model. They don't look like the cosmopolitans as defined in part one. The fact that they are here but not really here through no fault of their own, or no control or agency, I should say, not fault, agency of their own. That's it. That's the only thing that divides up the entire pocket of this extreme.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with what Sam was saying earlier about how I was a bit disappointed when I read part two. So I guess if listeners thought we were being negative so far, I don't know if it's going to be a smoother ride going forward. The way I would summarize it is just the way that Alvin dropped the idea of the perceived or the alters side from his theorizing to his operationalizing in part one, which we've already discussed. The thing that gets dropped out from the theorizing to the operationalizing in part two is the, like Sam was alluding to, the manifest latent interaction. And so now this latency is almost hard-coded with your organizational position or role almost, you know, and so that interaction is gone. The other promising thing in the theory side was where it almost felt like manifest and latent could be, I wouldn't go so far as to say situational, but definitely setting based. Let's say when you're in a classroom versus in a faculty meeting versus in a keynote speech or an executive course or whatever, different dynamics would come into play. But all of that becomes much more hard-coded by the time he starts building out archetype of these roles, because then now these are pretty much who they are across situations, across time, across parts of the organization, across times of the year or whatever.
Okay, so the first question I might ask is, well, are these characterizations still in some way useful? And the reason why I ask that is because I've done some stuff with the tripartite model of commitment and the three variables that were used in that. And I'm trying to think of the leading articles on that one. I think it's Rowan and Allen, 1977. I'll have to go back and check.
It's Mayer and Allen.
I say...
Sorry, it's Mayer and Allen.
Mayer and Allen, there we go. So I see a parallel with the three variables here and that tripartite model of commitment, which I think, you know, maybe this is one of those cases where, all right, Guldner found something, maybe he didn't really fully grasp what he was finding. I don't know what the relationship is between that literature stream on commitment and, say, what came here. But the parallels between those concepts are easy enough to follow. Instead of perhaps going after trying to partition role identities, the tripartite model of commitment asks, well, what keeps you here? What keeps you interested in the organization? Or what is it about the organization that attracts you? You wind up with some parallels, depending on the context, depending on the organization of, you know, each individual brings in some combination of, I really like it here, I'm obligated to be here because I owe the organization something, and the cost-benefit analysis of staying in the organization is preferable to leaving the organization. And then the combinations manifest in very, very different ways. And you can wind up with combinations that lead you to behaviors that look an awful lot like these six role identities, just maybe not exactly these six. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And related to what Rowan brought up in the first part about how there are vestiges of social psychological theory in this as well. So commitment is obviously a core concept in that, but also in this part two of the article, in his discussion of the home guard on page 448, I see shadows of an intrinsic, extrinsic motivation dimension. So he's talking about people whose personal history is intimately interwoven with the organization. There are some indications that they use an inner rather than an outer reference group orientation. However, their inner reference group orientation seems likely to be focused on a distinctive part of the whole organization, namely the middle administrative echelon. Okay, I don't agree with that last bit about falling in love with middle management. But the part that I do understand here as he's trying to work through what the factor loadings tell him is that some people do things for the money or the status or the power. That's what his throwaway comment in The Outsider says is. They would not stay if their salary was lowered, and they would leave to take a job at Harvard or Princeton, even at a lower salary. So, you know, he's talking about external indicators of status as well as money, as well as resources, as well as connections. So that's entirely extrinsic motivation, right? But then he talks about the rest of the job of keeping the university going, the way people used to talk about baseball, you know, for the love of the game. These are the intrinsically motivated people who have a calling, who are values aligned, which he does talk about explicitly, values alignment, who see themselves in achieving the mission. And this is, whether it is knowingly so or not, this is part of a large pocket of the literature that almost denigrates or talks down to callings and people whose professional alignment and calling speak to their internal values. And ASQ itself has a paper on callings. That's an award-winning paper on calling that we can link in the resources for you as well. But it's a tradition of, why do you go to work? Either because something about me and myself, or something about the offering, which exactly is what Tom just described in the tripartite model. And so there are tentacles of that reaching into this four versus two, you know, breaking our two by two into a four versus two, which, if you want to call it the relationship between social psychology and sociology, you can. Or really, it is, as Sam said in the introduction, you're trying to make sense of structure and institutions from the audience's side of the perception, right?
Yeah, just keying on that the comment that you made about the middle administrative echelon, if you were to substitute that with, in some institutions, you do have the faculty councils or faculty senates, and you do get people who, they may be otherwise ordinary members of the faculty, nothing particularly distinctive about them, but within the context of the role, it's not one that's officially in the organizational structure, but it is in the structure. And you do have really strong believers in being part of that type of organization because you're advocating extra hierarchically the views that might otherwise not be heard. and the dedication and, you know, going into those types of positions, there's people who really believe in that. And I think maybe he polluted his paper with a little bit too much specificity based on the context he looked at, but we can find analogs that are at least somewhat similar that can help with solving this generalizability issue.
Following from that conversation that we just had about meaning at work and the legacies of that in our current scholarship, there is a paper also about 50 years or 60 years later in ASQ by Drew Carton. I'm not mopping the floors, I'm putting a man on the moon. How NASA leaders enhance the meaningfulness of work by changing the meaning of work. Again, award-winning paper, such a fascinating study. We'll put it in the resources for you. But it's about how all of those roles, in this case, a night janitor, an office cleaner, is estates management, as they are termed here in the UK, all of those pieces contribute to the organizational mission, and feeling part of a mission greater than yourself and being aligned with that gives individual meaning at work. So when you look at what Guldner's talking about here with institutional values and alignment to mission, it's backwards direction, as Sam was saying, that he's looking at people in the roles they are currently in and how they feel about their role and what their ambition is in light of their current role. Whereas he does talk about the study of relations between cosmopolitans and locals in modern organizations can provide clues for the analysis of conflict within educational, government, hospital, and other bureaucracies. So he's hopeful that these other bureaucratic organizations will behave the same as the university he happened to observe. But I think if we take the discussions about calling the quote-unquote zookeeper's paper and meaning the quote-unquote janitor's paper and bring those into the discussion, by nature, we are bringing the individual back in, where we talked in part one and part one of the paper, how Guldner said, no, it doesn't matter about the individual, it's structural. But even by coming back around to that at the end of part two, I don't think the individual can stay excluded very long.
Yeah, I mean, along these lines that you all have been talking about right now, which is the ideas of commitment and bringing in a bit more nuance to it, I do think one benefit of part two and one value add from part one. So in part one, he talks about reference group orientation as simply internal, external. And by the time he's done this analysis in part two, now he's telling you which reference group. And so, for example, even within the internal, for the dedicated group, their reference is the organization's values. But for the elders, their reference group from where they get status or meaning is their peers, and specifically the cohort they kind of joined with and their informal social networks. And I think that I found that nuance to be quite helpful. Similarly, on the side of cosmopolitans and where he talks about how the empire builders have the department as a joint reference group alongside the profession, whereas the other category are more focused on the external profession. And so that move from internal external to which reference group specifically, I definitely found to be a bit more insightful.
I was going to talk about specifically my objection to the type of a true bureaucrat, but I think this applies to most of the types, which is when you read the explanation and the definition of each of these types, it's not so much about the characteristics or the identity, to use the same language, the social identities that are ascribed to them, like following the language in the first part where he talks about being pigeonholed and then the expectations that come with those social identities, but rather he's talking about what these people do, right? Like what they're interested in doing. It's a very, like, it's the position of the people in these latent roles that informs the definition of what the latent role is. And for example, with the true bureaucrat, that's I think the one that I disagree with the most, just in the label, because he talks about people that are not necessarily loyal to the organization and to its values and in its way of working, but to those in the immediate environment. And I think the definition or the idea that we have of a bureaucrat, both the colloquial one and the formal one following Beaver, is people that are so married and to the rule, right? To the way things, and they don't care if it doesn't work. They don't care if it's, you know, if it's causing more problems than what it's solving, talking about the immediate environment and those in the immediate environment, but it cares about following the rule. Whereas here it's kind of like a weird, it's kind of the opposite in a way, But then he finishes by explaining, you know, they seek to accomplish this taking over power over the organization by installing more authoritarian and formal regulations to control the behavior of others. And this is why he has termed them true bureaucrats, right? But I don't think I agree with that label. And I think it's this type of latent role is also an example of how it's not so much the social identities that are ascribed to these people, but what they are perceived to be doing and what they're interested in doing in the organization.
Exactly. And the other thing that struck me is that I don't think it's talking about what we would call hidden work. So things like who takes the job candidates to dinner, who makes sure that the department library has copies of the journal in it. So not even things that are part of someone's formal job description, this invisible work that keeps the department and the university going. That's what I expected when I thought that from the introduction, it would be about latent roles. It would be these unnamed positions, meeting note taker, you know, and guest visitor airport driver host. I thought it would be about identifying all of that invisible labor and then classifying who does more or less, and then expanding to talk about consequences for their labor mobility, their time and energy to develop expertise. That's what I was expecting when I suppose judged a book by its cover or judged a paper by its title. Then when we were promised, okay, we're going to be looking at role theory, and that to me is more about who adopts roles or who accepts the roles that are available to them. That's what I would say. If you give them back the agency, who accepts the roles that are available to them versus identity? If you say, okay, we're putting identity to the side and we're now only going to be looking at roles. Again, as Sam has said, the six sort of definitions that come out don't help us answer any of those things. And I think that's why we've all mentioned in different ways a disappointment, a letdown, a shortcoming, a gap that to be filled, is that we were looking for roles and individuals to fill them. And that's not what we got. We got a sort of back applied typology of individuals in existing jobs within an existing bureaucracy and their relative comfort with that.
This may very well be a case of a time when we didn't know what we didn't know. To what extent was hidden work understood? I don't know the answer to this. To what extent was hidden work understood or even discussed at Guldner's time?
No, I was going to say, I feel kind of bad being too critical because I love Guldner, right? I mean, especially the Patterns of Industrial Bureaucracy, I love it. I have a sense that why I don't love this paper as much is because it's not so much based on fieldwork as it in like observation as it is just on like interviews and trying to operationalize all of this. But what I was going to say is I think we're being fair in our criticism because he does promise that in the first part. But when he started asking these questions about, you know, how ethnicity or how the alternative identities of people influence how we actually treat them and perceive their role. And like he does kind of promise to be looking at this, but then he doesn't deliver, especially in part two, right? Like going back to what Sarah was saying, like you would expect to see this analysis of who takes notes and how that is associated to social identities. Like, for example, right? The classic example is the invisible work that women do in organizations, which is all about like caring and supporting and allowing other people to do their job better without that being part of the actual formal role and without that being visible or valued or rewarded, right? So that's what I was expecting as well, to see how people that are in the same manifest role have very different latent roles based on the social identities that they have and that are different. Even if you're both hired to be exactly the same thing, like you will have other kind of social identities that come into play. And that means that you end up doing your role in a different way and you end up interacting with other people in the organization in a different way. And I think that's what we don't see, right? Like it's still very homogeneous. Like who is in these latent roles that he explains in the second part? It's very close and very similar to the actual manifest roles.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the basis of the question. Exposing these latent roles, what latent roles he did show, was so far removed from what was understood as role identities before. The things now that we are very comfortable asking about and exploring, there just may have been no concept of that at the time. And so, you know, now what we're doing is we're going back and looking at it and saying that, you know, we're coming up with our own list of latent role identities that we think should have been included, and perhaps are a little bit more accurate representation of the things that we would have expected to see in this particular organization, like Faculty Senate.
Well, I think in order to answer that without our benefit of hindsight, we would have to ask a research-grounded question, which would say, what would be the consequences if these latent roles became manifest? In other words, how are we upsetting the apple cart? How are we revising the institution? And I think that's not in either part, not in the theory and the making of the case for these new constructs and departing from existing theory, nor is it in the definition and classification of these six phenotypes in part two. There's nothing that explains why these were relegated to latency, nor what would happen if they were brought into the light, if they were manifested. And that, I think, is what we would need to understand in order to believe or to follow along with the case for this theoretical contribution.
Yeah, I guess on the balance of things, Goldner promised value X and delivered value Y. And so the value X that he promised was what Sam and Sarah have been talking about. Especially if we go back to his kind of definition of social role, he talks about a set of expectations oriented toward people who occupy a certain position in a social system. But now what he's talking about is you could be the same professor with the same demographic composition in the same department, but have different preferences for how you identify. Like, do you identify more with your profession or with the organization? Do you feel a greater or lesser sense of loyalty and commitment, which doesn't really match up to what was promised, but it is interesting in its own right in the sense that, you know, perhaps if we stretch, kind of try to squeeze more juice out of this, perhaps an individual's preferences can set up a certain latent role where at that point I know that, let's say, Paul and Robert are both white male economics professors, but as a colleague, I know that Paul is really committed to the organization and Robert is not. And I do have different expectations from them, and I do treat them like cosmopolitans versus locals, even though they don't actually, in a social role sense, have different social roles.
Now, Sarah, you make an excellent point, because ironically, when you made your statement about, what happens if the latent roles become manifest, what immediately came to mind with me is the current day discussions about talent management and how we're trying to shift away from what gets branded as industrial age human resource practices, which is position-based in essence. It's based on defined specialties that people occupy, a position within an organization. And we're trying to, lots of we's in this one, trying to move to something that's a bit more sensitive to the unique skills and knowledge that an individual brings to an organization, or unique experiences and that sort of thing. And efforts to try to build organizations around that, especially, I would say, in the public sector, is problematic because of the way in which public sector organizations tend to be structured by specialty and rank or level or, you know, whatever stratification you tend to put onto it. And a lot of the things that they're trying to capture in this to try to make it manifest are latent in roles. So if you are an expert in language skills, there's a lot of other positions where language skills are really advantageous, but they tend not to be encoded because you can't hire against it necessarily unless it's a specific position for it. But if you were to make the ability to manage people by skills and their individual talents and that sort of a thing, you would be able to make it more manifest. But you end up with a completely different management system, one that defines its positions differently and therefore its roles differently. And it's complicated. I'm not sure I'm necessarily responding to your comment from a theoretical standpoint, from a practical standpoint. It's something that we are trying, you know, again, the grand we are trying to do. And it's hard because it's so completely different to the way that we think about structuring organizations.
I guess the theoretical answer to complement Tom's reaction to Sarah's question is role crafting, the study of role crafting, right? I think maybe we could see it as an attempt to bring the closer the latent and the manifest roles in organizations as well.
I think to go back and give credit where credit is due and to try and understand, well, why are we talking about latent versus manifest? As part of the conclusion at the end on 463, Goldner quotes from Merton about the rationale for studying latent structures. And he says, the greater part of sociological theory and research must be directed to the search for and the analysis of social patterns, which are the unintended byproducts of specifiable social forces and structures. It is essential that research be focused not wholly, of course, but largely upon the hidden and latent rather than the open and manifest functions and pattern of life. So that would have been more helpful at the front of section one of the article. But at least what it's doing is it's reminding us that everybody else is already focusing on the manifest. All of our existing social theory, all of our participant observations, and in a way, very quietly saying ethnography, you know, is focusing on the manifest. It's time to pay attention to the latent, to the unintention, to the lack of agency, to the structural forces, to the interdependencies. And so when you come at it from that position, you say, okay, that's why we're looking at latent roles, or we're hoping there are latent roles. And from what I've seen, I think it's these six. And then all this math supports my interpretation that there are six. And I think this is what they have in common and different with each other as a first proposal. And in this way, defining them against the manifest. If we wanted to improve it, perhaps what we would have suggested at the time would have been to ignore what was already there and start from scratch and say, what should be here? What would the bureaucracy expect? What would institution building need? How much of that do we have? And how much of that is hidden or latent? So I think if we credit the intention to change sociology and social theory that way, then I believe that bit has been achieved with the two parts of this article.
It just so happened I was trying to craft a list of those things that we had already kind of discussed. And maybe what we can do is we can explore these a little bit more and come up with some others. Because, for example, we've talked about hidden work. And the hidden work produces a number of role identities that do things like represent the organization to an outside group or prospective member or something like that, taking out the candidate to dinner. They're sort of like, you know, you as the individual member of the organization assume a latent role identity that is to represent the organization in things that are connected to an official action. Then there's those in which you are representative of the organization by virtue of who you are. Military gets a lot of this, like, you know, you're a soldier 24/7, 365, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365. So everything that you do outside of normal duties is perceived as representing the organization. Anytime that you know, somebody messes up, that is reflective on the military. So there's a lot of role identities, I think, that fall both of those representative traps. I shouldn't call them traps, both representations of those that are directly connected to some official standing or official counting of the organization. And then there are those that are just simply, you are a member of the organization. Like, I'm an American traveling to other places and I'm seen as an American. I'm understood to be American. So I'm sort of representing America everywhere I go, even though I don't intentionally manifest that. You know what I mean? There are probably some others that we can come up with that might explain some alternatives to latent roles.
I didn't fully get what you mean by alternatives to later. Or do you mean like just illustrating examples of it? Or
yeah, I started to run out of words there. But yeah, that's what I meant was, you know, maybe some alternatives to these six.
Correct. I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, because others are like environmental. You know, we can think of administrative assistance. Yeah, and I'm treading this business about manifest tied to the latent, and I know we don't want to do that. But think about you know, some of the roles in terms of morale boosting within an organization. The keepers of the cup and flower funds. Or because they tend to be done by certain people within the organization. So I'm probably treading too much there. But there are others who just simply volunteer to take on a responsibility that enhances the standing of, enhances the morale of the organization without necessarily official recognition. Struggling to come up with one that isn't run by an admin assistant, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. No, I think now I got your provocation, your question. So for example, something that I would have liked to see in the same study, in the same setting, if you look at faculty and not go for the obvious of senior faculty that, you know, or more kind of middle junior faculty, like you do have, and I'm sure you see this in your schools maybe, but you do have people that are maybe more individualistic in their orientation, right? Like you do the minimum in terms of teaching. You don't engage with doing a lot of institutional work or service. Like you do the minimum and you try to invest most of it on your own research, and you kind of favor the development of your network of research with people that are outside your institution. And then you have people that are more oriented to, right, being in touch with the students and trying to promote changes that will benefit people in administration or students as well. And you try to develop maybe seminars or things that kind of create more of an academic research community within the institution. So there I think you would see, and I'm curious to see how that correlates with some like major social identities in terms of like gender and ethnicity and whatever. But I think that's what I would have expected to see more, as opposed to these like really,
yeah, like this conceptualization of latent roles that are very largely based on the manifest roles themselves, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can, for the purpose of this discussion, crudely think of it in terms of three kinds of latent roles, just to move it beyond my man Alvin. One is latent roles based on who you are, and so that's things like demographics, gender, parenthood, etc. Second is latent roles based on what you do, and that's where our discussions on hidden labor comes in. And third is latent roles based on your preferences, and that's kind of where Alvin is playing with your loyalty commitment and what kind of reference group you get status from or identify with. And these can be interacting as well. So the person who is a dedicated local might be the person who is doing the hidden labor as well. And those two could have a reinforcing effect where I, as their colleague, now totally identify them with that latent role. So if I do have admin work, I'm going to push it onto them and not to some other cosmopolitan.
I think the fact that we are having trouble identifying these differences is reflected in the article and in the method itself. So on page 456, the question that then arises, however, is how the locals know which candidates are locals and vice versa. We must assume that locals and cosmopolitans can be ascertained and are differently identified by the electorate. So in other words, that you are in a class, you are in a role cluster, and you know it when you see it. But then if you layer on his point about homophily, that you tend to socialize with people in the same role grouping or demographic background or whatever your focal cluster is about, then this becomes self-reinforcing as well. So the paragraph or this section of the article goes on to almost set up a head-to-head. He talks about it in languages as blocks and winning and losing in a way that it was just supposed to be about identification. It was just supposed to be about classification, identification, and looking into the latent and figuring out what's going on. But he's already set it up as a very contentious difference. there, I think one thing we haven't talked about yet, which is how that sets itself up to talk about what follows in the article, which is popularity. So again, for me, this is a lovely little first bloom in the beginning of network studies, where he's talking about not using a method that's called name generator, where you recall people in your personal and professional networks based on what you need them to do. So he says, we actively didn't use the name generator method. We are special. We are different. What we did do is make a weighted index of the number of times they were chosen by our subjects and the closeness or intimacy of their choice. Okay. Not sure how he's defining the closeness or intimacy there. But then it goes on to say, okay, then we paired them with each other and we tried to separate it out. And lo and behold, the only notable difference among locals was that in the home guard. The home guard were the most popular. And he says, essentially admits it's the weakest part of the study. And what we now need is data that can tell us something about patterns of sociability or the sociometric structures and cliques. Well, isn't that perfect, right? That sets up for what he does next and what the whole sort of subfield does next is looking at cliques, sociometric status and power among cliques. So in terms of writing and moves within writing, it achieves quite a lot there. But in terms of what we were trying to do, which is understand these differences and whether they really map reality, even the subjects themselves had a problem in this study doing that. So we're in good company.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And what I was also taking away from this particular section, because I admittedly struggled with understanding what the tables were really telling me, is just, you know, how self-reinforcing some of these are. I think about my organization, which is a professional educational organization as well. So I can relate to some of the things about the university setting and how we strive, for example, to bring in more cosmopolitans, but wind up with a lot more locals just based on the nature of people we're attracting. And election to administrative council, I'm talking about hiring actions and promotions and things like that. And that in some ways, differences manifest more in terms of like how the, going back to what Guldner said about expectations, we're trying to espouse that we want to encourage more cosmopolitan behavior, when in reality, our culture is still firmly rooted in local behavior. The struggle that that creates in terms of, who are we as an organization is kind of up for question. I hope that helps.
Yeah, and I guess broadly speaking, I too wasn't 100% sure about the popularity measure, although I took great comfort in the fact that he used the cutting-edge ILIAC computer at the University of Illinois. By this point in the paper, I was trying to bring this in conversation with the concept of boundary spanners from the R&D and Mike Tishman literature. And I was kind of expecting that some of these cosmos or a subcategory of the cosmos would be the boundary spanners, because boundary spanners, again, have external and internally well-connected. And so they're able to translate between the two. But then he points out that, as would be expected, I'm quoting him, as would be expected, the outsider and the empire builder cosmopolitans were likely to be among the unpopular. For me, this also reminded me of how specific his findings are to the education institution and to the nature of work. So if we kind of bring work back in, episode 103, if we bring work back in, we realize that, yeah, a boundary spanner wouldn't have much to gain by bringing in, you know, if you're a research faculty, you're using external knowledge for your own papers, not to then also be popular among all the admin staff and pass it along and be well connected throughout the institution and administration. In a different organizational setting, you might expect the cosmos to also be internally popular because they have a lot to gain by kind of leveraging their position or their popularity is important to them, even if they identify with their professional group externally.
Yeah, following up what you just said, like I didn't buy this popularity thing because it just didn't make sense as well. Like you see who are the big names, like the most popular people in universities, again, using the same setting. I know, but it's like the first part of the paper is it's so much based on like right? Like common sense, like observations, like it's so nice. But then it's like, I don't know, like I even at the discussion level of like, what do we make of these results from these like fancy new technology? Like, it just doesn't make any sense, right? Like the people that are most successful outside professionally, like they are very likely to be popular within the university. First of all, because they bring a like much wanted resource of prestige and all that, but also because, right, like everybody wants to be associated with them. So that, yeah, it didn't really make sense. Maybe something that I think could strengthen this paper and this analysis was to discuss more the limitations or the nuances of these like ideal types, right? Because I do feel that you, for example, you can have locals and cosmopolitans that are at some point very loyal and very committed to the organization. But the conditions of that loyalty and commitment will maybe be different, right? So there is a point where you just give to the organization. And if you're not, and that's, again, that's a theory on organizational commitment. Like there's a point if you're giving a lot and you're not receiving something that you find equally valuable in return, you're likely to break that commitment. For me, like the part three of this study would be to go deeper into these conditions of that will then make the distinction of the different latent roles like more nuanced, I think.
And I would also say that the dynamics would be important. I mean, the way that the role identities are sort of presented here is that they're presented as though they're relatively stable. But of course, when we start bringing in commitment, we're thinking about how our commitment to the organization changes on a daily, even hourly basis, depending on, you know, what the circumstances is. Because sometimes I really love my job and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I wouldn't leave for 20 years. And other times I'm seriously thinking about an offer I just received or something to that effect. We definitely have a lot more knowledge about role identities, and you know, there's so much more we know about it now that was just not known at the time this was written. So yeah, part three follow-up, if somebody hasn't already written it, would certainly be useful here.
Sure. Just one thing I wanted to add is similar to how in part one we talked about how we liked the discussions at the outset and that were a little more at the abstract level about latent and manifest and about kind of role theory and social identity and experts in organizations. Similarly, here I quite enjoyed towards the end of part two where he again zooms out or abstracts out and starts talking about that trade-off between loyalty and expertise that organizations face in general. And I quote, he says, "The need for loyalty sets certain limits within which the need for expertise is pursued and vice versa." And to some extent, I start thinking about how these things change in today's world as, you know, it's all expertise and you can have loyal experts, how it changes when you have AI experts and loyal, you know, what loyalty means there, but also how what it means, for example, to in security organizations where actually that trade-off does hold true. You might not give security clearance to the person just who's the most expert at it because you have other considerations about, you know, are they committed to keeping national secrets and other things like that? In fact, later on page 466, he talks about how this trend of loyalty, of more expertise rather than loyalty, appears to be contingent on the decline of conflict, which then would suggest with the rise of conflict, you start shifting again towards loyalty rather than expertise or some other configuration of the two.
So, Tom, if you're asking us for our ideal future research section of the paper or where we would like this research agenda to go, one of the project's least developed sections for me that I would like to see studied and like to follow the trail throughout the history of management research is in the very beginning where he's setting up the theoretical considerations. And he talks about how social identities of group members, this is page 284, are consensually regarded as relevant to them in a given setting, and those which group members define as being irrelevant, inappropriate to consider, or illegitimate to take into account. So it's not saying that they don't know that there are other social roles, which is back to our conversation about hidden figures, unacknowledged work, the second shift, for example, all of those things. So it's not that they are unaware of those. It's that they have decided they are either irrelevant, inappropriate, or illegitimate. And I would love to see the agenda continue in those three lines and say, how is this all agreed, consensually regarded? What is the secret agreement to this? What are the moves that are involved in getting group of individuals for different levels of the institution, different loyalties to the institution and to each other, to silently and comprehensively agree these criteria? And doesn't that make a great title for a paper, you know, in the academic format? Irrelevant, inappropriate, and illegitimate.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.